The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, very good morning to you. Just turned 5 minutes past nine this Friday, the 13th of January. Hopefully you're not too suspicious out there today. Stay safe if you are. We are going to keep you informed and entertained for the next 3 hours in this show. Coming up very short, we have the Friday panel, a very interesting hour too, and Michael and Fionnuala too coming in between 11 and 12 to talk all things entertainment, and a couple of interesting guests thrown in there as well. Get involved in the conversation, of course. WhatsApps and text to 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 07491 25000. Your comments on email, comments at highlandradio.com, and look at, if you can, why don't you watch the show? Go on to YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. You can watch across our Facebook pages and directly on our website. Okay, so hopefully whichever way you choose to stay with us, you do so. Let's introduce our panel for this Friday morning. We'll say good morning first, I think, to Councillor Michael McBride, Independent Councillor in the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District. Unfortunately, good morning to you. Unfortunately, I don't know what happened there, what kicked in there. But anyway, good morning to you, Michael. I can't hear you. I don't know if you're muted or... Yeah, you are muted, of course. Friday the 13th. Breed, okay. Are you there for me? Breed, save me.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Councillor Michael McBride. Also, Breed Corrin, solicitor, regular guest on this item as well. Good morning, Breed.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, and great to hear you as well. And last but not least, Senator Pauline O'Reilly of the Green Party. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Greg.
Great to have you with us. Okay, I'll start with you, if that's all right, Councillor McBride. We were talking yesterday on the programme. It was highlighted at a recent... municipal district meeting, not yours, that people are not living in their allocated council properties. In some cases, they're renting them out on Airbnb. So what's happening is people have been given a social house through the council. The example was given yesterday that maybe they have a partner now and they've moved in with them. They're either the property's lying empty, or, as I say, we actually have cases of where the property ended up on Airbnb. Councillor Michael McBride, I don't think this is anything new, is it? I think maybe things like this are coming more into focus because of the housing shortage. What's your opinion? Have you come across this yourself, for example?
Greg, to be honest with you, my own opinion on it is that it's not acceptable. And to think that anybody that would have a house from the local authority that would be renting it out for Airbnb, it's unbelievable, especially, you know, like you say, with the housing crisis that we've got at the minute. So just been very frank about it. I'd just be totally against that happening, and I think it's unacceptable.
Do you think it's happening much?
Like, I don't think it's widespread, but look, I can't speak for the general public, you know what I mean, for everybody out there, but it's something that I don't think it's going on a wide scale basis. If it is, it's not. I'm not aware of it myself, you know. But again, like, if it is,
should you not be aware of it? I mean, if it is happening or isn't happening, as a local representative, who I'm sure there's lots of people on to you seeking, seeking a property, should you not know whether it's happening or not, or how widespread it is or not? Or if you don't know, surely those in charge of housing in your municipal district area should know.
Well, I would agree with that. You know, if it is going on, I suppose, you know, the problem is that the council really don't have the manpower for to go out and check house by house and what's happening. And, you know, I suppose at one time you had rate collectors going out and stuff like that, you know, they would have been able to keep on top of all those things. That no longer happens. But, look, as I say, I'd be totally against that happening. And I think if it is happening anywhere it is happening, the council should completely clamp down on it.
Yeah, Senator Pauline O'Reilly, what do you think?
Yeah, look, I think that the reality is that the councils haven't been keeping on top of Airbnb, full stop. And whether it is or it isn't widespread about it happening in social housing, I think we all know that it's widespread, that there are a lot of things being rented out on Airbnb, and they're not getting the proper planning for that. And it's something I've raised consistently over the last number of years. And it's particularly an issue for us in the West and the Northwest, where we have a lot of of homes that are, you know, they're tourist properties or they're summer houses. We have people who want to come and stay in our cities and in our towns. And actually, we also see the hollowing out then of town centres as a result of this Airbnb. So what we've done is to say it should be Bord Fáilte who are on top of what's happening in the tourist industry. They should be the ones rather than the local authorities who, as Michael said, maybe it's that they don't have manpower, maybe it's that there isn't the will there, I don't know, but it's been a problem for years. So Bord Fáilte are being given that responsibility, and there's legislation going through at the moment which will mean that they will have to check out, and people will have to register with Bord Fáilte their Airbnbs, and if they're not registered, they're not Airbnb.
Yeah, and I think that would address maybe the more, you know, unique headline-y case whereby someone is not in their council house, let's call it that, and they're putting it on Airbnb. But I would say what is a more widespread issue is people who were given a council house, their situation has changed, maybe they've moved in with someone or whatever it is, and that they're edging their bets or hedging their bets, and they're not handing the key back. They're not in that property, but they still are a key holder. Do you think that is something that the council needs to actively pursue to ensure that's not happening, so that those waiting for years on the waiting list have an opportunity?
I mean, I don't want to single out one group of people, because as I say, I think...
Well, we're not singling out a group of people. We're singling out a group of housing. I mean, we can't pussyfoot around the Senate. You can't not offend anybody. Do you know, we're talking... It doesn't matter if the background, it's not financial, racial, status, class... This is just people that are being given a social house, but in some cases they're not living in it, they're living somewhere else.
But what I'm pointing out to you is that it's happening on a wide scale basis across all types of housing, and that's what needs to be addressed. Because if something is if it's social housing and it's going up on Airbnb, it's wrong.
Okay.
If it's any other type of house that's going up in Airbnb and they don't have planning, it's also wrong. And it all needs to be addressed. And I don't think addressing one is going to solve the problem. I think it all has to be addressed. And that's why I think that Bord Fáilte need to have a proper role in it, because the councils clearly aren't doing it. And actually, whether it's a social house or not, the council is supposed to address it and is supposed to enforce it if people are operating an Airbnb or some kind of a tourist accommodation through a house where they don't have proper planning, and the council's clearly not doing that.
Understood. Breed Curran, what's your views?
In my opinion, Greg, this is all about housing need, and regardless of whether they're being let out on Airbnb or whatever they're doing, there are vacant houses. Unbelievably, there are over 166,000 vacant houses in this country, in a country where we are now in the midst of probably one of the greatest housing crises that we've known in modern history. I live in Galway, work in Roscommon, and about 2 years ago, one of the council employees in planning made contact with me. She was in part to do a census of vacant houses in the Roscommon town area. And she came and met me, and she was literally going through all the various houses around the area, wondering whether they were vacant or not. And I thought that was a very useful exercise at the time. And it's a case of manpower. If there is an issue with manpower in the councils needs to be assigned to these tasks, because it's saving money in the long run. If there's a vacant house, for whatever reason, it needs to be turned around and made available for someone who is on a housing list, regardless of whether it's rented out for Airbnb or otherwise.
Yeah, caller says these houses are not houses for life. They're stepping stones until you can get back on your feet. I think it should be reviewed every 5 years to open up to move on families who are ready to enter the private sector. And of course, then there are options to buy these properties and what have you. Is that something, Michael McBride, you think there should be a review every 5 years? These aren't houses for life, believes one listener.
That'd probably be a very good idea. I never really thought about it, Greg, to be honest about it. But, you know, any time that you can take something like that on any of them government programs and review them, I think that's always healthy, you know, to stay on top of what's happening out there. And I might fully support that.
All right, thank you very much for that. Any views on that? 0866 20 5000 or give us a call on 07491 25000. I wanted to talk about this last week because I think it's not an insignificant issue, but time ran out, so I'd be very interested in your views on this. Rates, the minimum wage hourly rate of pay went up in January 2023 to 11.30. It's widely reported that it's went up to 11.30, but that's if you're 20 and over. If you are aged 18, it's €9.04, 80% of what a 20-year-old at plus would get. If you're aged 19, it's €10.17. And then, as I say, age 20 and over, it's 11.30. And many would feel that's much lower than where it needs to be. I'll start with you on this one, if that's all right, Senator. What is the, how can there be any justification for treating an 18-year-old adult different to a 20-year-old adult, I wonder, as if in some way rent is cheaper for them, owning a car is cheaper for them, feeding a child is cheaper for them? Do you understand the, this logic? Or do you?
I mean, I think it's questionable personally. You know, I mean, in our party, we would believe that 16-year-olds should be voting, for instance. And if you are, you know, if you were saying that people have responsibility, that they're adults, or at least that they're decision makers, then I do think they need to be treated with the same respect. I suppose part of the explanation is that most people, but by no means everyone, are living at home.
Most 28-year-olds are living at home now.
Well, there is that, yeah, of course. And, you know, that maybe they don't have the same kind of outgoings. But I don't think that it really is for someone else to make that decision as to how many outgoings you have. You could be 20. And as you say, you could be 28 and have different kind of outgoings. And I think that there needs to be something else that takes account of that. For instance, you know, family support payments and so on, if you are earning below a certain amount, which the state does give. Now, I have to say that it is an independent body that looks and makes recommendations.
Is anything really independent, Senator?
Well, I mean, it is independent. And I do think it's a very, very welcome move to have the rates increased. And overall, I do think that a lot of people are happy with that their rates have increased. But I personally think that we need to look again at whether it is just that you do the same work and you get different pay. And part of the issue there, of course, is that you'll find employers then employing people who are younger because they don't have to pay.
And what a way, though, to start to set people off in their life, though. Do you know what I mean? Turn 18, maybe they didn't go to college or university. They just want to get straight into the workforce. And lots of people do that. And for 2 years, you're treated lesser than someone working next to you. And I always think businesses make the big mistake. If you reward people that potentially are underperforming, that always, I think those that try their best and try harder, if they're rewarded equally, you know, they will come down to the level of the worst employee. Breed, I can't see any justification for this. No one's going to convince me that this is right.
It's old-fashioned and it's outdated. I'm the proud owner of an 18-year-old, but for the last 2 years...
That's one way of putting it.
Let me tell you, my wallet knows all about it.
Yeah.
For the last 2 years, she's had a summer job working in a local shop. And while it's been a really, really valuable experience for her learning how to deal with people and deal with the public, she's been on a lower wage, but doing exactly the same job as those who are over 18. And while she, when I'd get on my high horse and say that I thought it was unfair, she used to say to me, you know, well, it is what it is. And she's very accepting of all that. But it's just really old fashioned. It's outdated. We have to start respecting our younger people a little bit more than that. There is that assumption that younger people are subsidised by their parents. And of course, I'm probably going to be looking after my lady when she's in her 30s and I'm in my 70s and 80s. But
you're very brave, Breed. You're very brave.
I know. She's not listening. She's in school.
Well, okay, that's all right.
And it's just so outdated. It was the Wage Commission, and it was a relatively recent decision that we would treat our younger people, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, 19, 20, and then giving them an adult wage when they reach their 20s. It's a relatively recent decision, but it's wrong. It's outdated. It has to change.
I think so. And I mean, it's just, again, it's another situation where young people will feel disenfranchised or that this country is not for them. And now what happens is young people are made feel like that. And now what we have really is older people are being made to feel like there's a problem. I just don't understand why society is set up like this. Councillor Michael McBride.
Absolutely. Instead of encouraging young people, we're telling them that they're not worth as much as those who happen to be 2 or 3 years older than them.
Or maybe they're in college. You know, maybe the ones that have gone on to college and university, you know, and you decide to start working, well, maybe it's a punishment for not furthering your education or something. You know, I don't know what the psychology might be or how people might receive it, but it could feel like that. Councillor Michael McBride, can you defend this? Not that it's your...
All, Greg, it'd be completely the opposite, Donna. I think, you know, if you look at it here in Ireland, when you reach 18 years old, you're allowed to vote, you're allowed to legally have a drink on a public premises. I think that's when you become of age. And in my opinion, you know, I think that it's probably causing young people to leave Ireland. The cost of living crisis here, you know, we're all very aware of it. And there's nobody can live in that kind of a wage anymore. They're forcing the young people to stay at home and live with their mother and father. And I don't think that's a healthy thing for people who are out working a full-time job. I think they should be moving out, making their own way in life. And it's unbelievable to see how many young people have left this country and went to Australia and Canada and such places over the last number of years. And this is certainly one of the factors. They're not able to afford to live in Ireland anymore. Or if they do work, stay here to work, they work all week. They have no surplus income. And I believe it's pushing a lot of our skilled tradespeople away from our shores. And we never needed these young people more than we do at the moment. You know, anybody that's in industry or in business will tell you that it's so difficult to, you know, to get people to work. And if you get an 18 or 19-year-old that'll come in full of beans and they want to give you a good, honest week's work, then give them an honest week's pay for it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, because this is the minimum wage. Employers are perfectly within their rights to pay them whatever they think they're worth or whatever they think is fair as well.
I think that's correct. You know, and I'll tell you, if you get young people into any business to work now, I think there's a lot of the people that are employing them, if they see that they're, you know, that they have the skills that they need, they're probably prepared to pay them more than that. But, you know, I think that there's some other people that look, they want to pay at the bottom end of the scale all the time. Maybe the businesses at the trades that they're in or the businesses they're in, maybe that's the nature of them, that they do pay at the lower end of the scale. But, you know, from what I've seen out there, the brain drain and the skills drain is a big, big problem. And it's something I would like to see stopped, you know, because we really do need these people to stay in our country. The industry needs them. You know, the construction business needs them. We're just so tight on tradespeople. And I think it's just so sad to see them all leaving and head to Australia, because if you talk to them, they'll tell you that they have a much better standard of living. And in places like Australia and Canada, they can work, they can socialise, they can save money. And a lot of them are coming home, you know, after a number of years and buying houses and stuff. Mm. If they stayed here, they just absolutely couldn't afford
it. But now a lot of them aren't coming home because they can't afford a house, or there's no house available, or it's... they can't get car insurance, and then, you know, there's loads of reasons as to why they might not. But Pauline, I think in this country, not just on this issue, but in many countries, on many issues, we tend to talk about what's happening now, what's happening in the past. Like, the kind of conversation we're having now, in 4 or 5 or 6 years, the CSO will release a batch of statistics that will show what will happen between now and then. You know, lots and lots of people leaving the country, shortages in certain areas and so on and so forth. I just wish we could be a little bit more proactive and say, you know what, these people are very valuable, not just now to us, but let's not even treat them as humans, right? They're very valuable to the economy and we need them here. I'm not saying that's the way we should view them, but, you know, I think that's how we should be treating people, with their worth and what they have to offer down the line, rather than saying, you know what, you're worth 9 euro and 4 cent an hour. If you want to go to Australia, head off, Pauline. And if I were a young person, I think that's how I might feel.
Yeah, I mean, I also think you made a very valid point earlier, Greg, about, you know, older people. I mean, if we were to turn around and say, once you hit a certain age, then we're going to change your wage as well and reduce it, And that would be shocking to us. I do think that there's an overall, you know, there's a sense of ageism here at play, and it's not right. And I think, again, Michael is correct. People leave the country. We know that they're leaving the country, and they're moving out of areas like the West in particular, young people. And we are left with older people, and that's not good for a society. We have to have a mix, and that means that we have to treat everybody with respect. And I don't think that is happening when we look at the wages, mm-hmm. certainly. Now, we have the highest level of employment ever in the country. So, you know, in some respects, you could say that it is an employees' market, and businesses are paying higher rates that, you know, for the most part, than minimum wage in order to get people, particularly in some of the service industries where they're struggling mm-hmm. to get people to work. So, you know, there is that factor at play as well. And so not everybody is on the minimum wage. But when it comes to this issue of the minimum wage, I just don't think it's the right approach.
Yeah. And before we move on, a caller says, what about the wage of the 16 and 17 year olds? It's terrible. Yep, that's $7.91 per hour. The reason I sort of didn't include that in this conversation is because 18, 19 and 20 year olds are all adults, you know, and maybe you could make an argument that, you know, someone in their teens can be treated a little bit different. But yeah, maybe $7.91 for the work they're doing in retail or in a bar or restaurant.
Work, you know, at the same yeah. quality, then it should deserve the same wage, because in the end of the day, it's the same people paying them. So I don't see any difference personally. Now, you could say that some people are almost like they're on their apprenticeship, but they're not official apprenticeship programs. So that I don't think that argument stacks up either.
A listener says,
I'd love to take a constitutional challenge, actually. If there's an 18 or a 19 year old there, I'd love to take a constitutional challenge in relation to the legitimacy of this and the constitutionality.
Well, can I ask you while you're on that issue, because it's been no one takes me on this, but I get contacted by young people quite regularly, Breed, who are refused entry to premises, licensed premises. Mm-hmm. They're 18 or 19. It's on an ad hoc basis, dependent how busy it is or not. They'd say it's over 20. They're told it's over 20s tonight or over 21s mm-hmm. tonight. Mm-hmm. That is
a different issue, Greg, in that when you have a licensed premises, it's entirely within your remit to either admit or
allow
someone
enter your premises. You can refuse someone access to your premises based solely on their age.
No, not based solely on their age, but I mean, it's still within the, whereas I wouldn't fancy taking a constitutional challenge to the High Court in relation to the point that you're making, whereas in relation to the minimum wage for 18, 19 and 20 year olds, or 18 and 19 year olds, I would certainly fancy a crack at that. In that I think it's clearly unconstitutional that you cannot define the worth of somebody's work simply based on the date on which they were born.
And why hasn't that been done yet?
Well, somebody needs to instruct a solicitor and a barrister to take that case.
A caller says, hi, Greg, I have three kids and every Sunday at the dinner table, I keep telling them to get the hell out of this country. Ireland is finished, Greg. Big time, thanks. Doesn't sound like a fun Sunday dinner to me. I'd be hiding their passports personally. But I suppose, you know, that's a parent or parents there that perhaps maybe they think the grass is greener on the other side and they'll grow as people and travel and experience life. I mean, Michael McBride, there's always going to be an element of young people that regardless of the status of this country that they're going to want to explore and what have you. The problem is it's many people emigrating now feel they've no choice.
I would agree with you, Greg, you know what I mean, and it's not always a bad thing, you know, that people emigrate and get a look around them. I suppose I was one of them people myself in the mid-80s when I finished up in college and there wasn't much work around here, and I had an opportunity to go to the United States, no doubt, there and spent 8 years in it. You know, you gain great experience in it, and it was my choice to come home. Some other people decided to stay in the States, and some of them have never been home. They're not able to, you know, travel home. But
it still would be classed, you know, like as undocumented.
It doesn't just work out good for everybody either. Yeah. You know, you have a lot of people that fall on this, you know, would fall in hard times when they're away and stuff like that too. But I suppose that's just such as life. But at the same time, you know, I think, you know, people that go away and come back, you know, they come back with good ideas with them and they become entrepreneurs and drivers of the economy. And it's not all bad, you know, but at the same time, I think it, we need...
It's when it's a choice, though.
Here,
yeah, it's when it's a choice, I think. That's the... A caller says it's experience-based, Greg. Younger people don't have the experience, so they need to work the 2 years to earn the full rate. Now, welding, maybe, plumbing, electricity, hairdressing, perhaps maybe I could see the argument there, but why start at, why would it start at 18 and 19? You could say the same then for a 20, 21-year-old, 25, 26-year-old, if they're just starting a new career. But I really appreciate the comment, but I don't get the point as such. I don't agree with it. Might as well just put it like that. All right, we'll be back with more from our guests. You're listening to Senator Pauline O'Reilly of the Green Party, Councillor Michael McBride, who's an independent, and Breed Curran, who's simply a solicitor, not involved in politics. They're our guests, and we'll be back with more of their wisdom after we take these messages. All right, we had the Agriculture Minister, Charlie McConnell, on this programme. Don't want to misquote him, but we were asking him about this deal with a British investment fund that Quiltshire was looking to do. He didn't really put his cards on the table as to whether or not he was in favour or against it, but his boss has tarnished a Micheál Martin wants to explore alternatives rather than selling land to a British investment fund in order to help meet Ireland's climate targets. It comes after it was revealed that thousands of acres of rural Ireland will be sold to the Gresham House Fund as part of a afforestation deal with semi-state agency Quiltshire. The plans have been met with a backlash from rural TDs among concerns that farmers could be priced out of buying land. And now the Fianna Fáil leader has called for a review of the process and said other models should be explored. Right, I mean, Quiltshire are making the argument, Senator Pauline O'Reilly, that, you know, they need outside money if we are going to meet 2015 targets. That being said, looking at their accounts for the last couple of years, they seem really quite well resourced, Quiltshire. I mean, we can understand where they're trying to get to, but what do you think of this approach that now the tarnisher says might need a bit of a review?
Well, look, if we're going to get to where we need to, you know, and this is on a global scale in terms of climate and biodiversity, we absolutely need both public and private investment. Now, the reports were incorrect in the first place. It's nothing like the amount of land that was being quoted at the start, but it certainly involves some land. But, you know, there is 1.3 billion euro there, and that is for farmers primarily, and Quiltshire can't access any of that funding. Now, if a farmer wants to sell their land to Quiltshire, even if that's, you know, another investor investing in it, that's a matter for the farmer, I would argue. And but the majority of that money, the 1.3 billion, is going to farmers because they're the largest landholders in the state. And ultimately, what we're trying to get to is a lot more forestry cover for Ireland. And as I say, that's going to be a mix. But once the land is covered in forestry, it can't be undone, if you know what I mean. So what we want to get to is that we have a lot more forestry, and Quiltshire is part of that. But in fact, it has only been a small part of that. It's not doing the job that it should be doing because it doesn't have the investment potential that that others have because it can't avail of any grants, which is correct as well. But that's under EU law that it can't avail of that 1.3 billion. Mm. So look, that's where things are. Of course, there's never any problem with having a look at things again to make sure that nobody is going to be ridden roughshod over. I think ultimately we want to make sure that farmers are paid a proper amount of money, that they can make a living regardless of what it's in, whether it's in forestry, whether it's in any other kind of farming. And let's be honest, that hasn't happened up to now. In some parts of farming. And so this massive investment, which has never, as I said, happened before, is to try and readdress that for farmers.
And it was welcomed by the farming community initially because they thought that was it. Now, do you have any issue if it is, you know, I mean, this is a investment fund that are looking for a return for their investors, you know, in terms of pensions and what have you. Do you have an issue with outside money being brought in to purchase Irish land?
It, as I say, it's only a very small part, and that's the reality. When it's private investment, it's going to come from a mix of sources, and we're automatically thinking, well, if something is coming from a pension fund, it's necessarily bad. It's not necessarily bad, but we do need, regardless of whether that be in renewables, whether that be in any kind of investment in Ireland in jobs. It's not all going.
The only thing is that what I don't understand is Quilch have quite a lot of money of their own. There's probably quite a lot of private money around in Ireland, and yet this deal's exposed where Quilch is doing a deal with a British investment firm that obviously are looking for a somewhat guaranteed return in their investment. It just that how we all arrived at that for me, is interesting and would require more explanation, personally speaking.
I don't think there's any issue with having a look at it to make sure that it is all above board. But, Quilter are saying they don't have enough money. And if that's not the case, then that's not the case. But it requires a massive investment, something like this in forestry. Hence the 1.3 billion, which is primarily for farmers.
Okay.
1.3 billion is a huge amount, and Quilter doesn't have anything like that amount. But again, the amount of land here we're talking about isn't massive in the grand scheme of things. It certainly isn't the
not an awful lot of land change. Yeah, but not an awful lot of land changes hands. So if even the parcel that we're talking of here changes hands at a higher price, then it does have an impact on it.
I don't think we are talking about a higher price, though. We're talking about things being on an open market, mm-hmm. and investors, whether they're private Irish or they're not, a farmer's entitled to sell their land to who they want to sell their land to. And as I say, it's not so much money in the market that's going to shift the cost of the land.
Mm-hmm.
It just enables Quilter to buy some land in order to do the job that it's supposed to be doing, which is to be providing more forestry cover and a variety of types of forestry cover. And that's what the new forestry plan is. There have been massive problems in the past with the wrong type of tree in the wrong place, too close to waterways. And that is completely, ruled out under this new forestry plan.
Okay. Bree Curran, your views?
My understanding was that Quilter have in their plan, with regards to meeting their climate targets, have agreed or have set the target of planting 247,000 acres by 2050, which is an area larger than County Dublin. And to me, it's simply to meet their climate action targets, but we need to look at the price of that. What price are we paying for Quilter hitting those targets? Your rent, and a lot of this land is marginal land. But what you're doing is you're rendering this land useless, because once it's planted and that's it. You cannot go back. You can't restore it back to the way it was, or you can't do anything other than forestry with it. And I'm just wondering, is this a cull by another name? Is this a suckler beef and sheep cull rendering land useless? And I would
think it's best saying that having tree is not useless. But anyway,
I'm sorry, Pauline, please don't interrupt me when I'm trying to make a point. And that's the thing that concerns me most in relation to all of this. I mean, I've personal experience of trying to get planning permission to plant marginal land. It took 2 years for the planning process, quite a bit of money. And in the end, we only got planning permission for part of those lands. So I wish the Gresham House Fund and Quilter luck in negotiating the Irish planning system for a start.
Maybe you're too honest in your planning application, Breed. Were you too honest in your planning application, perhaps?
I was. I said that I lived next door. and what I wanted to plant was native Irish trees. I didn't want to plant Sika spruce. I wanted to plant native Irish trees. And I was told after 2 years, yes, you can, but not where you want to plant it, and we want to reduce the area of the land that you wanted to plant.
But before we bring Michael in,
I wish Gresham good luck with the planning system.
Okay. Before we bring Michael in, Pauline, I think you wanted to make the point that you don't believe
forestry is... I didn't mean to disrespectfully interrupt. It's just I do feel quite passionately, and obviously, Breed, you do as well, if you wanted to plant native forestry, that a tree is not, planting forestry isn't rendering rendering land useless. It's actually very, very useful. And that's why I think it's really important that we have forestry for timber, for building, so that we can eliminate some of the cement out of the system, but also—
useless for farming.
But with respect, I think it is a farmer's— a farmer can make a decision as to whether they want to plant their land, and nobody's going to be forced to do it. So that's really important in this. I don't want the message to go out there that people, you know, wouldn't have the choice. Some farmers do want to plant forestry, and there have been massive difficulties in getting planning to do that. And this is to address that. Now, I understand that Caoilte do have a huge target to meet, but this amount of land is really very small that they're going to be purchasing, because they do have quite a bit of land already. So it's going to be a very, very small
part. Hopefully that's absolute clarity over how much land it will come out, because I think we can only really have a proper debate. Breed is quoting exactly what I heard as well, planting an area the size of Dublin, and then you're saying it's a slither, effectively.
I can give you the figures that I have, Greg, if it's helpful, and that just over 7,000 a year.
How big is that compared to Leitrim? I don't know what that means.
to a county. It's certainly minuscule compared to the 200 and X amount of 1,000 that's being quoted. Okay. We're talking maximum 30 over the lifetime.
There's enough there that the Tánaigh have said
by 2050 they want to have planted 247,000 acres of land.
I mean, there's enough here that Tánaigh Míchail Martin has interjected on it anyway, and that Charlie McConnell is meeting Caoilte, so it's clearly not half an acre or anything. Michael McBride, to the point though, does it matter? Should we not be maybe so parochial? Does it matter that where the money is coming from? It has to be planted. It seems to be the issue here is that it's a British investment fund that is investing.
Well, as most, Greg, you kind of touched on a point that I was just going to raise. You know, in recent history in Ireland, hedge funds have been more associated with buying up property, distressed property, of banks at maybe 25 and 30 cent on the euro. And these are properties that people like myself and yourself wouldn't even get a look on if we tried to buy them. So I think, you know, there's a very negative— people have a negative view of hedge funds coming in to do anything at the moment. And my own opinion on it is, I think, you know, I would like to see a lot more hardwood trees, native Irish trees planted in this country. And I think myself, you know, rather than going in and hedge funds buying massive swathes of land, I think there's a lot of land out there that farmers own. Typically, most of the farms that we know, they have got, you know, an amount of arable land, an amount of marginal land in it. And I think we should be looking at the marginal land.
Well, I think there is 1.3 billion for it. But as Breed pointed out, you can have the best of intention, but when you start to take on the planning, the planning authorities, you know, your enthusiasm can be very quickly dashed.
Well, you know, there have been programs in the past there where Caoilte have dealt directly with landowners, you know, and have went in and put in forestries. And I know where there's several of them at, and it seemed to be a program that worked quite well. A lot of them trees are coming close to maturity now. But there's one point I do want to bring up on this, Greg, and I've been watching it carefully for a long time. This last 20 years, Caoilte have been harvesting a lot of timber, and we see it right, left and centre around the county in Donegal. But you know what I wonder about is, I don't see them reforesting any of it. You know, they're not— you go up Mainaroy and have a look at it, you go back out there, the back of Glenveagh, heading down to Dunluce, they're harvesting down there. They're harvesting all over the place. They've done it out in Drumkeen, but I haven't seen them in reforesting again. So why not reforest the lands that they already have?
Well,
I think that'd be a massive amount of hectares there.
I think that'd be a good question for us to put into Caoilte, to ask what the plan is for these blocks of land that have been harvested. Are they going to be replanted? They might say, well, we have to clear it completely before we start the process again. I don't know, but listen, I think it's a really valid question, and one you'll probably look at yourself, but we'll certainly try and get some answers to. Okay, listen, really interesting views, as always, from Breed Corran, Senator Senator Pauline O'Reilly, and we're hearing from Councillor McBride as well. We'll be back with more from them, but let's take a quick break.
Cutting through the spin, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And almost every time I read a weather forecast where it talks about poor weather spreading from the northwest, I am minded of the former councillor who threatened to sue Metairn for damaging the tourist industry up here. I'm not sure how that would have succeeded, Breed.
I wouldn't fancy my chances on that one, Greg. No.
All right. Greg, Breed is spot on. It's cow culling by another name. Farmers were born to grow foodstuff and rare animals, not to plant trees. Another, there's two species of beetles eating conifers in Germany and in the US. Nobody in their right mind would invest in conifer plantations. Once sold, the next would be mining. Another, it's ridiculous that land is being taken out of the hands of Irish people who pay taxes. Good morning, Greg. They talk about planting trees like they will be fully grown next year and we'll all get to enjoy them. It'll be 30 years or more. But I suppose the target is 2015. And I'm sure, Pauline, you'd be of the view. I mean, we have to start somewhere. We can't. I mean, obviously, it takes a long time for certain trees to grow. But I mean, if we have these goals, yeah, you have to start at some point.
These grants are over decades, you know, so it's not a case of farmers being given money and then next week the rug is being pulled from under them. And as I say, it's entirely up to the farmer if they want to do it or not. And I don't think that we should be micromanaging farmers and saying that they can or they can't plant trees. But what we do have in new policy, we have taken hold of a backlog, which was ridiculous backlog of over 6,000 when we got into government, and now it's down to about 1,000. So it's not eliminated entirely, but huge strides have been made. And even if people now want to plant conifers, it has to be in the right place. They can't plant it if it's not. And there needs to be an amount of deciduous wood, an amount of natural native hardwood within that mix, and it's absolutely not acceptable for taking out huge swathes of forestry and not replanting, and certainly isn't under the new plans. So that, I think, absolutely, if that is happening, needs to be investigated.
Well, they need to, as I say, there might be a logical explanation, but the only way we find that out is by the likes of Michael raising these points. For some reason, the government has rejected suggestions that fresh assurances should be sought from ministers that all of their property interests and declarations are in order. It comes after Fine Gael TD Damien English became the second junior minister to resign in less than 6 months over issues related to property interests. Both Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and Tánaiste Micheál Martin said Mr. English had made the right decision to leave ministerial office. Now, it has to be said as well, by the way, the paper I'm holding, the Irish Times, nor the Irish Independent, nor RTE, nor any of the other papers or media have exposed this. It's two former journalists, one of them actually from South Donegal, that have been working on issues like this and have brought it to the public's attention, held ministers to account to ensure they live by the same rules that we are. One of them has resigned and the other had some explaining to do. So fair play to them is what I'm saying, and I think it shows the established media up, if I'm completely honest with you. Breed Corran, why would the government resist sort of an audit of properties owned by ministers? I mean, they are legislators. Two have already been found out to have made mistakes, let me put it like that. Let's get all our cards on the table if there's nothing
Absolutely.
To hide.
Robert Troy before Christmas and now Damien English. Yes, I mean, trying to wipe it all under the carpet and say there's nothing to see here, nothing to see here, seems to me very, very foolish. It seems to be that, you know, a root and branch investigation of these issues would certainly quell the uneasiness that people in general are having with the body politic at the moment. And it's more important than ever that we trust our politicians, because we're hearing, you know, all sorts of voices on social media, particularly in relation to the current immigration crisis and the Ukrainian refugee housing crisis. And it's so important that our politicians stand up and say, you know, we make the rules, but we also live by the rules and work and operate within the rules, because people are just getting very, very uneasy. And it's a politician's job to reassure the public that they have our best interests at heart. So I can't see any reason for refusing such an investigation.
Yeah, and especially when ministers like Minister English have stood up in the Dáil during debates and, mm-hmm. and made comments about people's interaction with the planning process and the need for honesty there. I just wonder if that trust that you talk of has been lost irreparably now to some point.
I don't. I think it's in peaks and troughs. I mean, if you look at history, I was reading a really, really interesting book recently about the aftermath of the Spanish flu pandemic after the First World War. And it seems that history is just repeating itself. The breakdown of after that pandemic and their version of lockdown, we had the rise of the right. We had Hitler coming into power. And all those horrible, ominous signs are happening again. We just have a breakdown at the moment of trust. Yeah. And it's our politicians who have to regain that trust.
Okay.
Be seen to be obeying the rules that they actually make.
I don't know where this hour has gone. It is absolutely flown by. So we only have a minute each. Michael, I mean, in the interests of, I think, public trust, the government should listen to opposition demands, and let's get our cards on the table from the ministers.
Yeah, as opposed, you know, as a councillor myself and all politicians, you have to put on a declaration annually.
Oh, no, they do too, but you have to make sure everything's declared. Yeah,
that's the thing about it, you know, and I just wonder why people just, you know, don't put it in honestly, you know, put in exactly what they have, because I don't think there's any problem with it, as long as you're doing everything above board, and if you're not, then you deserve to be taken to heel for it.
Right, Pauline O'Reilly, Senator, what's your view?
Yeah, well, as Michael said, I mean, we do, all of us, councillor, senator, TD, minister, everybody has to put in returns every year and they have to have those sworn. Mm-hmm. And so I don't understand why somebody would be dishonest. And that was clearly what happened in this case and in the previous case. I think the correct course of action was taken to resign. But if they didn't resign, I think they'd have to be removed from their position as minister, because it is really important that we have ethical standards, because it reflects badly on all of us.
Pauline,
and I don't think that's fair.
I agree. Pauline O'Reilly, Senator O'Reilly of the Green Party. Lovely to have you on the programme again. Thank you so much for your time. Greatly appreciated. Councillor Michael McBride, the same to you. Have a lovely weekend.
Thank you.
And last but not least, of course, Breed Corrin, solicitor. If you have, if someone tries to take that case, keep us informed, will you, as it relates to... listen, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Amelia.
Bye-bye. Take care of yourself. All right, OK. We've got loads of your comments to catch up on, and much more besides after the news and obituary notices. Stay right where you are.